In this episode, we speak to Sweet Joy Hachuela, who takes us on a journey of entrepreneurship and what it means to work through imposter syndrome and just show up as our beautiful, whole, and grounded selves. Listen and enjoy our talk with Sweet Joy.
I am Blanca.
And I am Ray.
And this is Woke at Work.
Today, we're welcoming Sweet Joy Hachuela to the Woke at Work studio, or should I say virtual studio, actually, as we are all quarantined in our respective houses during this COVID pandemic. It's such a wild time. How are you all holding up at home? Sweet Joy, Blanca, how are your households managing?
We're adjusting. I mean, that is the word. You know, we've been now in lockdown for 3 weeks and everything has completely changed. So very blessed that my family and I, my husband and our two little girls and myself are healthy. We're safe.
Yeah.
We have food in the fridge and we have each other and we have work.
Right.
And so
it's like come down to like being grateful for like the basic things, right?
Yeah. At the end of the day, that's what you have. But, you know, but also at the same time, still trying to also manage, you know, expectations and emotions. And so
100%
working through that and, you know, just trying to connect with as many people as I can, because this is isolating.
Yeah. So yeah, we get to do this interview as a form of connection still,
yes.
Even though it's not under the ideal set of circumstances. Blanca and I were so proud of ourselves because prior to all of this, we had really completely redone the podcast studio and had planned out this whole thing where we were going to have wine and mimosas and fruit and
grapes and cheese and crackers, all the things, pictures, Polaroid shots.
Yes, all of this just to make this feel homey and just like we were hanging out as girlfriends. And now we're looking at each other over Google Hangouts instead, but still happy to be having the conversation. So thank you so much for still making it work. Even in the midst of, like you said, all of your responsibilities, having to mommy and be a wife and run a business. So in the middle of a pandemic.
Yes.
So thank you.
And I have to say, when you first approached me, when I saw that email, Ray, I just felt really honored to be part of your podcast. As a woman of color, it's important that we come together and we talk about our challenges, our opportunities, our successes.
Yes.
And right. And learn from each other. So very, very honored to be part of this with you and Blanca. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. We appreciate you being here. We can't wait to have the listeners listen in on all of the gifts and treasures that you're going to share with us. So
Sweet Joy and I met because our children attend the same little, I call it crunchy independent school. I don't know if a school could be any crunchier than where our kids go to school, but it's a sweet little place and our daughters are in the same classroom. And we actually first connected at my daughter's 10th birthday slumber party. Do you remember that party, Sweet Joy?
Yes, I remember that party.
Yes,
it was vividly.
Yes, it was quite memorable because actually in my house, we refer to it as like the plague party because it was the beginning of everyone in that class just falling ill to the flu, almost everyone. Oh. You said your household was spared, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But that night, one girl went, well, I was already feeling under the weather, but I thought it was just a little cold. So I was sipping tea and you came over to drop off Amara, and you and I got to chatting, really, I think, for the first time.
Yes.
I don't know
yes.
that we'd had a lot of opportunity to interact before that. And we found out we were both doing diversity work, and we mm-hmm. just sat down and you mapped out my whole training plan for me.
I felt so bad because I could see that you were so sick and you had all these girls running around waiting to go to the mall. But no, I made you take out a piece of paper and a pen so I could map out how you were going to do trainings to all these core members.
Right. It was a free consultation. Free consultation. Yeah,
it was exactly. It was a free consultation. So don't feel bad because I was new to the role and I was like, okay, like still trying to decide how I was going to, you know, form it and what I was going to do. And so talking with you that evening was actually really helpful. But that night, one girl went home sick. She was so sick. She was crying and had a fever and just didn't really feel well. And then the next day and every day after, I mean, every girl who went to that party was just out. The whole class, they were just out with the flu. There were days, I think, where they had like 3 or 4 kids in the class. Even the teachers eventually got sick. Yeah, and I feel like my slumber party is the reason it happened. We were like the spread, like they're talking about with the coronavirus. We were the hub for the flu in the class that year. But I'm so glad you said that your household was spared, which is amazing. another little slumber party story I'll throw in is that Sweet Joy is known to throw a slumber party every year for Amara. And you're really famous for this cake that you make that my daughter talks about all the time. What is that cake?
It's not even a cake. Like Amara, she's 11. But I do love to bake and I do love to cook and I do all these things for my kids. And she hates cakes, but she loves pies. And so her request for that birthday, I think it was 2 years ago, was she wanted a pie with different berries.
Okay.
And so I just made a huge like casserole of like different berries. So a blueberry section, a strawberry section, and like a raspberry section.
Okay.
And it all just melds together. And since I was too tired to give it the night before, so when they woke up, it was like, breakfast! This is what you're having.
Well, Savannah came home talking about it, and she was like, Mom, her mom made this pie, I guess, like you said, and she talked about it for months after.
That's so sweet.
Yes, you are famous for that. But
I'm not letting my kids hang out with y'all because this whole slumber party stuff, it doesn't happen in my house.
Oh,
we
my
can
God.
Have a whole podcast on the cultural pieces of this.
Oh my God.
Although it's irrelevant, I guess, if everyone's a woman of color, because my whole theory was like, people of color don't have people sleeping over their house. I don't know you.
Blanca, you are so right. Like, this was new for me. Yeah, I did not want the slumber parties, but because all the other parents were having slumber parties,
it's true.
I had to open up. And also the teachers were encouraging to have slumber parties.
Nope.
And for me, as like, you know, growing up as an immigrant, the only place that you had a sleepover was your cousin's house.
Yes,
like
totally.
You don't go to your friend's house. I didn't go anywhere until I went to college, and that time I had a dorm.
Yeah,
so, girl, I got you. But I think this whole new world is just.
I often find myself giving into like the peer pressure of where our kids go to school because the expectations are really different, you know, in terms of, I remember when they first started, I had a parent reach out to me wanting to know if she could pick my kid up from school. I think it was my son and take him out somewhere with her son. And I was like, I don't know you. Like, I've never met you. I don't know your name. Like, I'm from, you just didn't do that.
No.
But,
no.
You know, it's hard to like maintain that, like the way we grew up in the face of, you know, the kids going to school where the cultural expectations are just really different because all of a sudden you start to look like an overprotective, you know, kind of crazy mom when your kids don't get to go to your kid's the only one who can't go to the slumber party.
Well, I tell them, listen, I'm overprotective because I got to protect my black and brown babies. So that's, you go into the movies, I'll be 5 rows behind you.
Oh
yes,
my gosh.
I will.
Oh my gosh.
Same way. way.
I am the same way. And the whole flu thing you just said, Ray, I'm like, I don't want anybody's germs up in here.
Listen, they survived. They all made it.
We all made it. But you know what? I have to say, my husband is Swedish and, you know, it's different. And so when we're in Sweden and he's telling my kids, you know, go off, be free, go to the woods by yourselves. And I'm having the worst panic attack because I'm like, what if somebody takes them in the woods?
Yeah.
I'm like, last time they found a wild boar. They thought it was great. No, have your phone. They're like, we don't need a phone. Like, have your phone. I thought it was just me being overprotective.
I'm buying that bubble. There's this thing on that's trending in social media during COVID-19, this guy who was spying on this woman, not spying. He was using his like drone to ask her out on a date. And they went out on a date during COVID-19 when everyone's quarantined and he put himself in a bubble. Go look it up, y'all. If you haven't seen this, it's supposed to be a cute love story. I'm a little freaked out by it, but hey, but he bought a bubble and I was like, but where is that? I'm about to buy a set of four. Like, that's what I want.
And you'll use it post-corona.
Listen,
I have to tell you, it's hard because, you know, I grew up as a latchkey kid. And so I think part of it too is that I want to give my kids some independence so they can take care of themselves when they're out in the world.
Yeah.
And so it's this whole like balance of like,
it is
of like keeping them safe and you feeling like comfortable that they're safe. And at the same time, not to corral them. So when they're not with you, they can take care of themselves and feel confident that they can navigate the world. That's where I am right now with an 11-year-old.
Yeah, well, that's where I got to be. And New York definitely helps with that because it's the expectation that kids are, you know, moving themselves around as much as possible.
Yes.
So in addition to being, you know, a mom who is trying to keep everybody safe and out of the woods, Sweet Joy is also the co-founder and partner of the Medici Group, which is a business solutions firm that helps companies innovate by leveraging the power of diversity. That sounds like a bunch of professional speak, I know. But basically what you all do, I think it's actually really cutting edge and it highlights diversity in a way that I don't often see talked about, but you're basically helping companies understand that attending to diversity, it's not just an altruistic endeavor. It's not something that you do just because it's trendy or it makes you feel good, but it actually makes good business sense.
Yes.
Because diversity of race and culture and gender and all the different ways we can attend to diversity, it actually leads to teams that are diverse in thought, which helps businesses to innovate. And so my understanding is that this is what your company, the Medici Group, goes in and helps executives to understand. Is that how you would sum it up?
Yes. And I'd like to just add a little piece to what you just said. And what we do is we help organizations, big Fortune 500 companies, governments around the world, large nonprofits like the United Nations to help them leverage diversity and inclusion.
Mm.
Inclusion is the big piece to this.
Yeah.
Because if you have diversity and you have different types of people working, that doesn't guarantee that you're actually, you know, bringing in what their skill sets are or their ideas into the work or their organizations. You need inclusion because that's when you actually care about bringing in people's different perspectives and actually using it.
Yeah.
And
so you're not just diversifying for the sake of it or like bringing in brown faces or gender inclusivity and saying, okay, look at us, we're a rainbow. Like, that's not good enough.
That's not good enough. And actually that hurts it. That's where you get the backlash. Oh, you're only here because you're a woman of color. Oh, you're only here because you're a veteran. Or you're only here because you have, you know, a certain type of ability.
Mm-hmm.
It is really bringing in people's different backgrounds, experiences, education, their networks into what the organization and the team is doing to solve for very complex solutions and challenges. And so we help do that to help them drive more innovation, more growth, because everybody wants growth. People want to make more money. People want to increase their market share or be, or even with a nonprofit, be better in terms of serving their communities.
Yeah.
And also in within that is that it's how to drive high performing teams, because that's where work actually gets done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that. I read a book, Diversity and Inclusion in the Workplace. And that was the first place where I heard this idea of, listen, you can't just go to these companies and say you need to be diverse, you know, just because, like, that feeling, that altruistic, you know, nature that I want it to look a certain way. That's only going to get you so far. And especially with executives in a, you know, we're a capitalist society, everybody's trying to make money. And if you can make the case that, if you can make the case with these companies that attending to diversity and inclusion, to your point, and mm-hmm. belonging, I think is another part of it.
Oh, absolutely.
And, if you can attend to those things in ways that actually matter, it's going to be good for your business.
Yes.
And so I think we get a lot more buy-in that way. You and I, Sweet Joy, we also have a couple of other connections. And so I think this is what got us talking so much at the slumber party that night, is because I shared that I was the diversity and equity director for City Year New York. And you said, oh my gosh, I did a City Year in Boston, right?
Yes. And actually that completely changed my life. I mean, that is part of the reason why I'm doing the work that I'm doing. So yes, definitely.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
Yeah. And so that just got us talking. And then found out that you also did some consulting work at my alma mater, Spelman College.
Oh my gosh, I forgot about that. Yes.
Yes.
And that was wonderful work. And it was wonderful to work with Dr. Tatum. I helped them really bring in the Asian American and Native American perspectives in the Women of Color Conference that they started a few years ago. And so
Dr. Tatum was my president, actually. So you must have been there. Isn't it interesting to think that we could have been walking the campus or something or in the area at the same time, and then all these years later, just meeting up in this way? The world is so interesting.
Yes, the world, I think, is great in that way. Serendipity is wonderful in that way.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we've been talking to you, Sweet Joy, for quite some time, but I'm wondering if you could just tell folks about your identity, about who, you know, a little bit about who you are and all those components. Like, would that be, like, we need to get into that and let folks know. Who is Sweet Joy? And can we get a taste of, what do you identify as? What are your identity markers?
So I am Filipina American. And, you know, and for that, you know, in my early 20s, I really struggled with my identity, like who I was, because I grew up in the States. I was born in the Philippines, but mostly grew up in California. And in my early 20s and started doing work with communities and also just trying to find myself, who was I in this world? And it because I didn't feel like I completely belonged. Mm. And then I had an opportunity after 20 years to go back to the Philippines. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to find my people. I'm going to feel good. I'm going to know who I am. And then when I went to the Philippines, it was similar to the feelings that I had in the US. In the Philippines, everybody looked at me like, you are, you know, the American, you're from the States. Yeah. And they treated me a certain way. And of course, for me, I felt like I didn't belong because I haven't been there in 20 years. And so coming back from that experience, I just resigned to, you know what, this is who I am. I am a Filipina American woman.
Yeah.
And, you know, and for now, you know, where I am in my life, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a friend and a daughter and a sister, and also an entrepreneur and a business executive.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I, and those are the different parts of me. I love to bake. I love to cook. I like to make things pretty.
This reminds me of when we were having our initial conversation and, you know, again, Corona had really just started to get really, you know, prominent and kind of crazy. And we were having our video chat and you were sitting in like the front area of your house, like out, like a lot of homes in Brooklyn, there are two doors. Yep. There's the outside door and the inside door. And you were sitting in that space and I was admiring how beautiful the wallpaper was.
Yeah.
And you had your teapot and teacup. Yes. And you were like, I like pretty things. I'm like, me too.
I think for me, it's just creating a space where you find beauty in things.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be expensive. It's just making things comfortable for yourself, and especially during these times where things are, you know, are everywhere. And so for me, like having that semblance of being grounded, like, you know, I picked flowers for my garden, I put it like where I'm sitting, you know, that just helps me get through the day.
Yeah, totally.
And so, so those, you know, Blanca, I loved that you asked me, who makes me? Who makes Sweet Joy? And so those are the different aspects of who I am.
So I have to ask this because I know I'm not the only one thinking, is Sweet Joy your like birth, like you're like, that is your name, that's your government name? Or is that like, you know what? I just want to be Sweet Joy. Like I am sweet, I bring joy, I'm going to be Sweet Joy. Like, is
wouldn't that be cool if we got to name ourselves like that?
I would not have named myself White, for the record. I would not have named myself White in Spanish. I'm
Blanca.
But Sweet Joy, like, what is that your?
Yes, it is. And you know what? Everybody asks. And also, I have to train people I know, because, you know, especially my colleagues and my clients, because when people start asking them, is Sweet Joy really her name? Like, she like made that up, or her parents were hippies. So I've gotten a lot. And so really my name comes from my parents. And when I was born in the Philippines, in Cebu, they didn't have a name for me right away. It's not like here in like the US, like before you leave the hospital, like you have to give that, you know, your baby a name and it's on a birth certificate. Well, they had a few days. And so from what my mom has told me is that I was a really happy baby.
Aww.
I smiled a lot and I laughed a lot. And my cousin, she actually suggested, Auntie, why don't you call her Sweet Joy?
Aww.
And you know what? God bless my parents, because, you know, I didn't name my kid Sweet Joy. but, you know, they took that chance and they're like, okay, we're going to name this baby Sweet Joy. And it's been a blessing to have that name. And and actually later on when I was in high school, a classmate of mine came up to me and said, you know, there's a poem with your name. And it's a poem by William Blake. And it's called Infant Joy. And in this poem, he talks about how he names this baby girl. And at the end, it's Sweet Joy.
Oh, so look at that.
Maybe it's, you know, she got that inspiration from there. But, you know, it's been a blessing to have this name and to have this name. And sometimes, you know, I kind of take it for granted. Oh, I'm Sweet Joy. Or when people come up to me and say, oh, you must be happy all the time. I'm like, no, I'm not happy all the time. Please.
Oh, but you were a really happy baby, at least.
I was a really happy baby. And what's great is that when people do meet me, and it's great, there's this certain reaction that I get that it's just, that is a nice surprise.
And what it makes me think of too, and like we might get into it later on, is just how our names become markers. And as you think about like resumes and how they show up and how they might be barriers, it's just like,
oh my gosh,
this whole process of ownership and like, that is my name. And so that's why I was like, wait, let's just for the record, that is your birth government name, right? Like, and to have to, like, I imagine as a person of color and as a woman to show up with a name such as Sweet Joy, and it's not, I'm not just about emotions, but I'm about business too. Like, you know, so.
And you know what? I'm glad you actually said that, because I've had some challenges to my name or how my name shows up. Like, you know, when I was trying to apply to medical school, one of my counselors, you know, he was also Filipino American, and he suite. Cut out the sweet. I'm like, excuse me, but that's not my name. He's like, oh no, if you have these doctors looking at your application, they might question, you know, who you are as a person. I'm like, no way. And, you know, there was another woman who said, don't put this in your application. I'm like, why not? It's my name. Well, it just sounds corny. And, you know, there's a few, and it's been interesting in how people translate my name when I actually email with my signature, where they think that it's a nickname. And, you know, they want to call me Joy.
And
with my husband's book, my husband wrote the Medici effect, and it was translated in Swedish. And so the Swedish translation isn't even my real name, because they translated sweet as like a little nickname. So
interesting. Oh my gosh. Well, you know, it reminds me of, I forget which country it was in Africa, but they had a president. Remember his name was Good Luck John or Good Luck Jonathan, yes, something like that.
Nigeria.
Okay. And there was a big discussion then, and you know, people just kind of, you know, not taking it seriously or questioning, like, is that his real name? And I remember reading something about it and someone really having to help them understand that, first of all, don't, you know, hold us to your American standard of, you know, your Western ideology behind how you name people. But where we're from, very much like you said, we ascribe names to our children that, one, either reflect the character of who we think they are, or that speak into their lives what we wish and what we hope for them, right? And so that's what his parents wanted for him. So they named him Good Luck John or Good Luck Jonathan, I think it was. Yeah. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I love that you own your name and that you force people to call you by your name as well. I struggle with that. My name is Ray Tanisha, and it's hyphenated. It and the Tanisha does not look like a traditional Tanisha, and I basically have two first names, and so I always really just drop the Tanisha and just go with Ray and don't include the hyphenated part. Yeah, I found it easier. I don't have to explain it. People trip over themselves to pronounce it. And so I have not gotten to the point where you are, where I force people to say my full name, but I love that you own it and are proud of it, 'cause it's a beautiful story actually.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. And it's going back to identity, and it's owning who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's a big piece of it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the work that you do a little bit. You have so much experience working with like a really impressive array of companies. Yes. I was looking at the Medici. I guess I'm saying this wrong. Medici. I know it's not Medici. The Medici Group. Yes. I was looking at your website, and I saw that you've worked with companies from Disney to MasterCard to Spotify. Yes. And one of the challenges that I find working in diversity is that companies are always looking for like a quick fix or like a magic pill, especially when they're working with consultants. They're just like, come in, fix us, you know, make us what we need to be. And particularly in these last years, post Black Lives Matter movement, companies like Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Facebook, and Google and Starbucks, which was really public. We've seen these companies place really big bets on accountability. And sometimes I think like they're all just looking for their diversity badge. Like, you know, we did it. It's kind of like how buildings can get like
the certificate of completion.
The LEED, you know, like we're a LEED certified building. No. Sometimes I feel like companies are looking for that. And what are you, in your experience, what do you think are some of the biggest roadblocks that companies face in their attempts to attend to diversity?
So you just said one right there, that they are seeing this as a check the box. Mm. Give me a badge. Give me a certification. Mm-hmm. And that's just not how diversity and inclusion gets integrated into the culture and the business strategy of an organization. D&I, or diversity and inclusion, has to be seen as a key driver for that organization in terms of their business growth. Mm-hmm. If they see it as a standalone, like it's just an HR problem, or it's a something that we could do for corporate social responsibility where we go out to our communities, it is not going to work. It becomes ineffective. This is where a lot of organizations struggle. What we've seen and have it work, and where our work has really been successful, is when the CEO and his or her leadership team and everybody, you know, from the top and all the way down to the rest of the employees, see that diversity and inclusion is a value to their business. It's a value, and it's a critical factor in how they perform their work, in how they're getting evaluated, and how they get a promotion, and how they get their bonuses.
Yeah. Because so it has to be infused into like the whole culture.
It has. Yes, it is. Right. And it has to be infused in how the executives and their leaders integrate it in how they look at and plan for their business. Because it's not just about employees. It's not just about making people feel good. It's about how do you bring in all these different talented perspectives that we've invested in bringing into this organization? How do we bring in all their ideas, their backgrounds, everything that they do into what we're doing so we can be better as a company? We can be much more successful, especially when times are uncertain.
Sweet Joy, can you tell, so just a lot of the consulting that I've done too, a lot of people are like, oh, well, let's just get chief equity officers or diversity coordinators. And then they'll do the work, right? Like, and you tell you now, instead of me paying a consultant, let me get you on our roster. You have filled a role and now you help us do the work, and you do the work actually.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about thoughts on the role and what that person, if that, because a lot of our listeners, I think, played some of that role, right? Like some of, we are the chief equity officers. We are, you know, the people who are like, well, look, we'll talk about diversity and inclusion in your hiring practices, in the, you know, in all of these structures. So can you tell us about that and like what your thoughts are, or how Medici group approaches it?
In terms of the role of the chief just like diversity officer?
Yeah, any of those roles. Like, what is the role that they play?
So it's what you said, Blanca. You know, some of these roles and the responsibilities is that piece of it. And this is where, you know, chief diversity officers, and it's great that it's chief and not necessarily a manager, which is, it's really having an organization seeing the value of someone in this position in a higher level. Where we've seen success is if the chief diversity officer or chief inclusion officer is reporting to the CEO or has a dotted line and a very close relationship with the CEO. And, you know, sometimes or most times, sometimes reports to the CHRO. So you get that visibility, you get the influence. And where I've seen a lot of success is also a colleague of mine who's a chief diversity officer actually reports to the chief strategy officer versus the head of HR, because D&I is seen as critical in terms of the plan for the company in terms of growth, along with its people.
Right.
So really the role of the chief diversity officer is critical, especially when it comes to influencing business and business unit leaders and also heads of functions. They need to see that value of why it's critical for them to bring in diverse perspectives and practice inclusion.
Yeah,
because it has to be tied to what their compensation is, not necessarily compensation, but their business performance. If it's just an HR issue, if it's just hiring, that's all they're going to see it. And they're going to wonder, why do I need this? Because what is expected of me is to really perform. Is I have these benchmarks that I have to hit. I have these goals. I have to have my teams reach these goals. What does diversity and inclusion have to do with me, especially if I'm a white male?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, where am I in this conversation? Like, what is that? Why is this good for me? And so that's why it's always critical to match up diversity and inclusion to what the business performance is, not just for the organization as a whole. You have to bring it down to people's individual levels in terms of what they're working on.
I would say that was one of the lessons that I learned in my role when I was serving as equity director for City Year. It's just that I think initially people felt like, well, of course, this is what we should be doing. You know, we're in communities of color.
Yes,
our core members are you know, largely people of color, particularly in New York. So this is something we should be doing. But where the disconnect was originally happening, initially happening was at the managerial level. Mm-hmm. And so like the executive director was super bought in, and then the people on the ground doing the work, but it was that managerial level that we're just like, well, okay, I get it, but what does that mean for my role? Like,
exactly.
What should I be doing? Why should I care? Why does this matter? If my goals say that I need to be doing A, B, and C that don't, you know, readily seem to be connected or tied to diversity, you know, I can just kick back and let you do all the work, right?
Yes. Because that's your job. Right. That is your job, Ray.
Exactly.
That's why we brought you on.
Right.
And so that's why, you know, where some of the biggest roadblocks is with the middle managers, or, you know, it's been called this for a lot of years. And this is where chief diversity officers or diversity executives have challenges, or just an organization, is what they call the frozen middle.
Mm.
It's the frozen middle because you just don't get any traction.
Yeah.
And so how do you have this population really understand why diversity and inclusion is important? And this is why, you know, in terms of this level, it's bringing it to how is D&I going to positively impact the work that they do? That it's not about just sending their people to employee resource groups events. It's not just about going to trainings. But where is this impact in terms of their own business? Because at the end of the day, that's where they are going to be held accountable for. This is where they're going to either get a promotion or not a promotion, or get a bonus or not have a bonus.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, I was looking at some research that talked about, it was actually a report by GuideStar. And they were really highlighting the fact that these one-off trainings, like the highly publicized ones that happened with Starbucks, you know, where they shut down their stores for like half a day, I think it was. And then they were like, we're diverse now. We get it now, right? but the research was saying like how ineffective those kind of one-off trainings are, and actually how they can really highlight biases and make them worse, you know, a lot of times, which I found super interesting, especially in light of the fact that so after the whole Starbucks thing happened, their CEO was doing a town hall, I think it was like Anderson Cooper or something, and he literally said, "I don't see color." And I was like,
they didn't cover that in your training.
like common Yes, it's your whole company shut down so publicly for, were you not there? I mean, it just shows you how, you know, that one-off kind of, all right, let's spend a couple of hours, like that's not going to get it, right?
No, it's not. And this is what we've seen in the work that we've done in over a decade and working with 4,000 teams globally and working with all these executive teams, is that most of these solutions regarding not just D&I, but any type of culture or leadership change, is that they are not as effective because they're somewhat, you know, there's some question in terms of sustainability, in terms of the mindset and also behaviors that go with it. And most of these solutions are either organization-wide that, you know, you know, the whole organization is going to go through it, and they're also individual. And so where
you're
we
saying
see
that
this,
they should be individual?
No, they're
or
not.
They're not.
Or they are individual and it's not happening, because usually this is what happens. So an organization needs to work on diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's unconscious bias. And so they send all their people, all, you know, individuals going into these trainings, could be 2-3 hours, half day, full days. And so, or certain, maybe it's a special program for high potential women, high potential people of color. Mm-hmm. They go through these special programs. And so they go through them, they get some really great information, they get maybe some tools that they can work with when they get back to their organization. And that's great. It's great in terms of awareness. But what happens is then they have to go back to their teams. They have to go back to their specific units, and they have to start working with the people that they've been working with. And so for them as individuals, either just an employee or a leader, they have to then translate all that information back to their team or back to their manager.
And so the people, the team that they're working with or their manager, they're not working from the same framework and the same understanding. So I see what you mean by the the problem with it being individualized is that, okay, so now I'm woke, if you will, but now I got to go back to this whole team that's not on the same plane that I'm in.
And I've seen it, and I don't know if you've seen it this way too, Sweet Joy. We've had, I mean, I've done some trainings where it's been both directions. So we've done work, and I primarily work within the education sector, but like you do work with teachers, and teachers like, all right, good, got it. Now I'm going to do this with my kids, but my boss doesn't have it. And my boss is still messed up. And then we've done work with executive directors who are like, okay, I think I got it. I haven't figured out how to translate it across the board to everyone. And somehow there's this like ownership of, I have to figure this out for everyone else. Yep. And I was like, is it that by nature, the opposite of being inclusive? Like, aren't you like, isn't this about a collective team? And so I don't know if you've seen some of that pattern.
I have seen some of that. And, that's where there is a disconnect in terms of what people are learning and then sustaining their learnings back into their work. And so what we've found is, you know, it is really down to a team level. And so how we've helped our companies do this is that we coach teams in integrating what we call the Medici principles, which is founded on diversity and inclusion, and integrating it in how they work and also perform their goals. So they become much more faster, much better at coming up with innovative solutions, especially at this time of COVID. People are struggling. People are scrambling. And so the teams that we are working on, are working with, we're coaching them in how to come up with solutions and bringing in different perspectives and inclusion to help them come up with innovative solutions. And what we've found has been effective is when you break it down into the team level, then everybody gets the same learning and they're actually using it because they're doing it every day in what they're supposed to be doing. And this is an important piece around culture work and culture change, and especially around behavior, is that they're speaking the same language. They have the same frameworks. And so this is where we've seen just much more, just sustainability and effectiveness in terms of behaviors and mindsets.
Awesome. That's really exciting work that you all are doing. I want to be exciting. Like a so fly on the wall or sitting in the back corner of a talk or a workshop or something that you all are doing. That sounds really, really innovative. I want to talk a little bit about the specific experiences of women of color in these spaces. One of the things that you've talked about is imposter syndrome. You know, that's the idea for our listeners who might not be familiar with it. It's this idea of not feeling like you belong in a certain space you find yourself in. It's a psychological term.
Right.
You said, like, Yeah, doubting yourself. Even you can come in with all the degrees and all of the experience, and because of the way that we've been socialized as people of color, to constantly believe that we have to prove ourselves, that we that we belong in this spot, we have these internalized fear that we are going to be exposed as the frauds that they already think that we are, because we're not smart enough, we're not capable enough. It can have no basis at all in reality, but we struggle with it. And so I'm wanting to know if this is something that you've struggled with, and how do you think that we, particularly as women of color, can combat it?
Yes. So thank you for that question, because this is something I struggle with, and I have to be honest, every day. You know, it was definitely much more challenging in my early days in my career. But, you know, and I think part of it is, you know, not just with society, but also family expectations, and feeling that in order, and this will come up later when we talk about martyrdom, is that feeling that, you know, I have to know everything or seem to know everything, because if I don't show up not knowing, then it's going to put shame on me and put shame on my family.
Yeah.
And so there's always this, I like to say the little voice in the head, or the little voice in my head that says, you know, not good enough, not smart enough, not articulate enough. And you know, when we've talked about imposter syndrome before, there's just been conversations like, you know, you just get a wand and it's like, poosh, it's gone. And I have to be honest, it does, for me, it doesn't fully go away. It becomes diminished in terms of their role, or their voice. But, you know, I have to go back and sit down and take a breath and close my eyes and just be grounded and start telling myself, that's not true, what you're telling me. I have accomplished this. I've done this. I've done this. You've done well here. And that's a way to get me grounded so I can, you know, get back up and do the things that I need to do, because I've done those things before.
So it sounds like you have like a pep talk that you give yourself. I think, like, as women, we should all do this. Like, we should pull up our notes section and just literally list all the reasons we are total badasses, right? And when we need it, pull it up and be like, like you said, I've done this, I've done this, and just give ourselves that pep talk.
Yes, because I think for us, it's, go ahead, Blanca.
No, I was just going to say, it just reminds me of watching cartoons and that little devil that pops up on one side of your shoulder and the angel that pops up on the other side, right? It's just like, no, I can't listen to you. And it's just like, but it's really hard to like get, like, is it okay for me to actually say all of these good things about myself? Is, you know, and so I don't know. It just makes me think of like the duality of those existences and try to reconcile with it. I always tell people, I think I have voice, like you said, voices in my head. There's a constant dialogue in my head that and I'm so grateful that no one can read my mind, because they'd be like, wow, this woman is all over the place.
It's been hard, but you know, it's something that, you know, that's a tool that I use, and, you know, and for me, I feel that I have to constantly prepare. That's another way. That's a tool for me to, okay, so I feel insecure about going into the meeting. So what do I need to do to take control and make sure that as much as possible, I know how things are going to flow?
Yeah.
And so when I do come in, I'm much more prepared in how the situation is going to play out. And, you know, of course, you know, not everything plays out well, but for me, it just is this, it's the things that help me feel grounded. And that is the thing.
Yeah. So I love that. You You take some time to ground yourself. That mm-hmm. means closing your eyes and taking some deep breaths before you go into the meeting or the talk or whatever it's going to be. Reminding yourself of all the reasons you actually yes. are prepared for this moment yes. and how your life experiences have led you there. And yes. then having your internal list of I've yes. done this, I've been here, I you know, to say, I am prepared for this moment. I love that.
You know yes. what? You just reminded me of Sweet Joy. It never hit me. So I remember being in a leadership training, like summer thingy. It's a training program. And I hated public speaking. I was not a fan of that. Part of it is that, like, are people going to dissect it? Do I have too much of an accent? Like my New York accent, am I going to like butcher words? Am I going to say sayings the wrong way? All the things, right? Like that we go through in our head. And this is like after having served in leadership roles, after having degrees, having been like all yes. of that stuff. And then I had this woman who was a mentor, friend, mentor, coach, all the things since then, who was like, what's something that grounds you? What's something that gives you yes. power? And I was like, I do yoga, but I love warrior pose. And so she was like, I want you to come up here and do a warrior pose. And I was like, girl, no, I'm not going in the front. Did you hear? I hate public speaking. I don't like being in front of everybody. And so somehow by the end of the dance session, I was in the front doing a warrior pose.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
And so if you ever have the joy of standing behind me 6 feet apart, thank you very much. And you see the back of my neck, I have a tattoo of the warrior pose. And what? So when I became...
I have never seen this right. tattoo.
You don't stand behind me. I have a tattoo on the back of my neck. And I have this tattoo as a reminder, because when I used to go in, when I was a principal, it was really hard for me to have like people who know me are like, well, you're pretty direct. And I was like, yeah, but the buildup to get there, no one knows about that, right? Like yes. no one knows about the yes. script that I have. No one knows yes. about the heart palpitations. My palms yes. are sweating. I will not shake yes. your hand because my hands are going to give me away. Like all the things, my lips used to quiver. I fix all of that. But like that for me. And so at some point I actually used to do a warrior pose for the ones that were really hard for me. And so you just reminded me, I totally have taken it for granted now that it's there. I don't see it.
Yes.
But it's like, it's a constant anchor for me that women of color, we are warriors. Like we are.
I love you know, that.
Right. Like yes. we have yes. that strength. Like we run homes, we run businesses, we run things that people, we make things afloat when no one knows.
Right? That's right.
Right. So
and so it just makes me think about like, how dare white supremacy culture cause us to question our own power? Like, how dare you? Right.
Yeah.
And so you just remind, I totally forgot I had this tattoo. I have all my tattoos on my back. I can't see any of them. So they're behind me, but I forgot that was like, for me, my own grounding was in yeah. like yoga and the power in my body at that point, you know, to like give me that. And so I, you know, just sharing with you and the listeners of like, oh my gosh, that was like 20 or whatever, how many years ago? Cause I'm still young.
I love that, Blanca. Yeah. That's so great.
I think that's helpful.
Yeah. And it kind of feels like fake it till you make it a little yeah. bit. It's just like, you know, I'm up here and I'm strong and I'm, you know, speaking truth to power and I'm showing up authentically, but you don't right. know that my heart's beating fast and yes. that my lip wants to quiver because I'm not going mm-hmm. to let that right. stop me. Right. I'm going to stand here in a place of confidence that I might not totally feel yet, mm-hmm. But I'm going to stand here in my warrior pose as if I do. So
right. I love that.
Yes.
And I love that, you know, and it is about getting out of the head
mm-hmm. yeah.
because everything, I think with imposter syndrome, like everything is in your head, and like to get as much out of it out to like whatever type of grounding you can put yourself has just been helpful for me.
Yeah.
So Sweet Joy, I want to know how do you take care of yourself? Mm-hmm. You know, as a powerful, you know, woman of color who runs this organization, this firm with your husband, you're a mother, and so often as women of color, like we mm-hmm. go above and yep. beyond. We're taught that we have to, really. You yes. know, like I think so many of us grew up with that saying of having to be twice as good as the next person, really, to get half as much as how it was told to me. But you
and
know,
to Olivia Pope, and we all remember that episode of Scandal. Her father said, "You got to work twice as hard." Didn't I tell you work twice as hard?
Right. And so we grow up working twice as hard. And you know, and I've said it before. I love this whole Black Girls Rock. I love the whole, you know, I'm a put my cape on, all this kind of stuff. But honestly, it's exhausting.
It's awesome.
It is. Like, yeah. I am not a superhero, actually. Like, I'm literally not. And I have my limits. I have my breaking point. And we fall into this martyrdom that we are literally sacrificing our physical and our mental health to keep up with this ideal of I can do it all, right? Mm-hmm. How do you keep from falling into that pattern if you do keep from it? I don't know. You know,
That's actually a great question, because it's not, you know, I just think about, you know, myself and why I, you know, sometimes, you know, I just haven't stopped. And, you know, I was just home with my mother just a few weeks ago, and she has Parkinson's. But the thing is, the woman can't stop. She's cooking at 5 a.m. She's cleaning the house. She's sweeping the backyard. She can't stop. And I looked at her and I'm just like, this is where I get it. This is where I'm like, she doesn't have to do anything, but she keeps going.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. And I think for me, what's been helpful is that, you know, I've been going to therapy for, you know, on and off for the last maybe 15, 20 years.
Wow.
And that has helped me tremendously.
Yeah.
And,
I'm a big, big proponent of therapy. I try to talk very openly about it because, as you all know, especially in communities of color, there can be such a stigma attached to it. You know, I grew up in church and my mom saying,
God is
all
your
you need
therapist.
Is Jesus. Yes, all you need is
you
Jesus.
You just need to pray. You need to go to church and pray. That's what I get.
That's it.
I'm like, oh, mommy, no. She's like, God is my doctor. God is my healer. God is my therapist. I said, well, what can God be our teacher? Why'd you send us to school all those years?
Like, okay, right. Could God be that too? Oh, but no, and religion, and certainly it has its place. Certainly it can be a grounding force for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I am one of those people, but I can have Jesus and a therapist, right? Yes. Like they don't have to be mutually exclusive. So I love that you talk about that. Can you share, like, what have been some, I guess, major, have you had any aha moments
or
major learning experiences as a result of this kind of care for yourself?
Yes, actually, it's been the last few years. And it goes back to taking care of yourself. And really, in 2017, at the end of 2017, I hit a wall.
Yeah.
I remember being at a client office in Boston, and I felt like I just didn't want to continue doing anything. I was exhausted. I mentally, physically, emotionally, and I just didn't know what to do. And so I called an old therapist of mine. I had been out of therapy for the last maybe 5-6 years, and she said, you know what, I'm not practicing anymore. I'm gonna connect you to this other therapist who I think is great, who actually also used to run a business. And so I connected with my therapist, and it's just been really life-changing, especially for these last few years, because I had to figure out, why was it so important for me to keep going? Why did it feel so good to, you know, what, you know, to, like, you know, just run from here, run from there, do this, do that. And one of the things I learned about myself was, like, I saw that as being important. Like, if I did all these things, like, that's my value. But at the same time, I felt like I was going to crash.
Yeah.
And so it took a few years to realize, you know, some things that I learned from my childhood, being an immigrant child, having to support the family, having to figure out what being in the U.S. was like. And to navigate it, like, those, you know, some of the things I learned helped me become successful.
Right.
But at the same time, being in my 40s, having this company, raising two girls, and, you know, working with my husband, those things were not supporting me anymore. They were taking a toll of my emotional health
and my physical health.
Oh my gosh. I love that you just said that. Like, it's not supporting you anymore. And right, because it doesn't mean that those things didn't have their place when you needed them growing up. And I think we all have like similar stories in that way, you know, just really having to grow up and make a way and push through and go to college and get the degrees. And we needed to probably be on 10 during that time, but not now. Like, it gets to a point where it's no longer serving you. It is harming you. And I'm so glad your therapist helped you to realize that, because my therapist helped me realize the exact same thing.
It's this broken pattern. Like, how do you break these patterns? And I often used to tell people that I coach, like, what got you here? Just because you use these tools to get you here doesn't mean you need to keep these tools. And I think a lot about that for those of us who are raising girls, right? Young girls. What am I modeling for you? Like, you can't cry, you can't take a break, you can't, like, all those things. And I'm like, oh, damn mirror that I'm holding up to myself now. Right? Like, because then part of it is like, you know, which will, you know, there is a whole group of people that I'm like, you know, you still do need to work hard. You're not just given things because you're born a woman of color, right? Like, so, so how do you balance
quite the opposite.
Thank you for sharing. I'm wondering though, Ray, I know you and I have talked about this and have asked previous folks, you know, who have come on the show, just about like our 20-year-old selves, right? Like,
yeah, I think about this a lot because I'm literally raising a 20-year-old and she is so, her and that entire generation, I feel, I don't know what they're called. I don't know if they're Gen Xers or what they are these days. I don't keep up with the names, but they just have a whole different set of expectations. I laugh because she's in college in Atlanta, and I told her after her freshman year, I was like, okay, I think it's time for you to get a job. You know, I supported you your freshman year. I told you didn't have to work, get acclimated, but now you need to work. And so she went and got a job at like one of the local chain restaurants, and she was there a couple of weeks and then she quit. And I'm like, why? And she was just like, they didn't like my hair. You know, they were telling me that I couldn't wear my hair a certain way. And I was like, okay, you know, that's fine. Like, on the one hand, the equity director in me was like, well, you go, girl. That's right. On the other hand, the 80s baby have to be responsible side of me was like, well, honey, change your hair. Right. Like, that's what I was thinking. Then she got a job at an ice cream parlor and she quit there because they didn't let her keep her nails a certain length. And I was just like, oh, my gosh, like these kids nowadays, they have zero expectation of having to code switch. Like, they are not here for it. And they want to work for places that are diverse, where they can show up as their full selves. What advice would you give to these 20-somethings who are entering their careers and they have these set expectations of the kinds of places that they want to work? How can they know if the company that they're interviewing with is such a place?
And that's also in itself really challenging, because if you're going into these major organizations and you want to start your career, there are going to be some, you know, some set ways in terms of culture, but you can navigate and figure out, okay, is this a place for me where I can be a value add, not a culture fit? Because with culture fit, like, you can go in there and like, okay, you don't fit that culture, goodbye. Or so it is about adding. It's about adding who you are as a person, but also you're adding to something in that culture, but also to the organization as a whole. You know, just pretty practical things that they could do is they can do research. They can go look at, you know, top, you know, places for diversity, or Google the company name and, you know, their own diversity initiatives and see, and just, you know, learning more information from that. What, you know, sometimes I recommend folks to do is to Google the leadership team. What does that leadership team look like? You know, is it pretty diverse? Is it, you know, how are they talking about diversity in their website?
No, I was just thinking, I would think that, like, you know, I'm thinking of like my 20-year-old self in college, and like, if it's a service job, like what are the things that I'm not going to budge on, right? Like
that's
my
right.
hair is a part of me. So am I really going to cover my hair? My nails, they might be a part of me, but I can cut your nails, boo.
You can cut your nails.
Yeah, like your nails might be a little bit different and like right. they might not be practical if you going to be bringing some plates out to people. Like, I don't know. my husband makes fun of me because he's like, you never worked in a service-oriented job. I was like, no, I've only had bougie office jobs. Thank you very much. But like, there are certain things that, like, you're scooping ice cream.
Right. Nobody wants to see your claws going down into the ice cream bowl and scooping their ice cream. So I like that, Blanca. Like, what's your
bottom line?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
If they are getting out of college and starting to look for a job where they can then, you know, at least having it be a starting point for their career, there's other, you know, websites that they can look at. There's Glassdoor that they can look at in terms of reviews. And also there's another site. I know the co-founder, it's called Fairy God Boss, and it's targeted towards women. Women's experiences in the workplace. And also, and this is how I've navigated my career and just understanding organizations and how people's experiences are, is to really find someone in that company who's worked there or who is working there to like understand like what is it like to work here and be successful.
Yeah, I love
that.
Yeah, do a deep dive. Start, who do you know there? Who do you know that knows somebody who works there? And ask them for like a real time assessment of what it's like to work there. Because of course, when you're in the interview, everybody's putting on their best face, right?
Absolutely.
And particularly if they're recruiting you and really want you to work there, they're going to say all the things they feel like they need to say in order to get you to go there. So talking to people could be valuable. Sweet Joy, this is something we'd like to ask everyone. What would you say to your 20-year-old self?
So
I want you to think back to 5 years ago.
Right.
I do feel it. Actually, I like being 28. Like 20 years old was a time for, me being in college and not knowing what I was going to do with my life. Because I knew I was, I wanted to be a doctor, but didn't have the grades to be a doctor. And so there was a lot of uncertainty in terms of that time. And, what I would tell myself then that I'm telling myself now, because we're facing another set of uncertainty of what this pandemic is going to be doing in our work and everything else, is that everything is going to be okay. That coming out of whatever things might look uncertain, you might not know what things are going to look like. It's going to be okay. And looking back, it's going to take you to a better place than what you even imagined before.
So true.
Yep.
It's going back to my mantra, because you're creative, because you're a survivor.
Yeah.
Because you figure things out. You have resources and a network and support. You are going to be at a much better place than you could ever have imagined.
Sweet Joy, I love your self-talk. Okay. Can I just say that? Like,
you haven't even had your affirmations yet.
Yes, I know. But the way you speak life over yourself, you said you have resources. I'm just like, yes, absolutely. Like, tell yourself these things. And these things that can be so hard to fully grasp and grab onto at 20. You just don't know. You cannot imagine that things can work out for your good when you're in the midst of being confused, being unsure of yourself, not having a clue which direction to go. You can't imagine that just getting started on the path is enough to start leading you to all these different unexpected journeys. Experiences. So that's really, really great advice. And like you said, especially now, as people I think are losing jobs with unemployment, I don't think we could have fathomed that unemployment would be in the millions at any point in this country. And people are probably asking themselves, what is next for me?
Yep.
You know, like what, What if this job doesn't come back? What if this company doesn't survive and continue to thrive in the way that we were on a trajectory to do? What then? You know? Yeah. And so I think many of us are feeling kind of like our 20-year-old selves right now.
You know, being an entrepreneur at this point in time and pushing the company forward, like we are in those times. Ray Blanca, I know, you know, with you know, your company, like it's a different world. And it is, you know, and it's navigating. And that is something that I've had to tell myself every day when I wake up.
In this segment, we invite our guests to share a woke at work story. It's basically what we call their wow story, as in, wow, I cannot believe that just happened to me, or wow, I cannot believe he just said that to me. So, Sweet Joy, what is your wow story?
My wow story, one I can think of right now, was when I first started my career in diversity. I was working at JP Morgan and I was looking at other opportunities to manage diversity in other global corporations. And I had this opportunity to actually meet with a chief diversity officer who was looking for a manager of diversity for his organization. He was an older man of color. I had met him at a diversity conference and had, you know, such a lot of respect for him and the work that he was trying to do. So I come into his office, I sit down, we have a really great conversation. I got to know who he was as a person, how he built his career, and then we went into what I would be doing for the job. And so he said, well, you would be helping me execute on our company's diversity strategies. You would be supporting the work with the employee networking groups or resource groups, and you would be representing me in meetings that I can attend. And I'm thinking in my head, this is my dream job. This is awesome. I love this, whatever I can do. But then he added, oh, and then get me coffee.
Oh.
And I'm thinking,
oh my, was he serious?
Yes, he was serious. Wow. Yes, he was serious. He looked at me with that twinkle in his eye.
No. And what was your, I mean, what did you say? What did you do? What did you say?
It was my wow story in my head. I was thinking, did he really say that?
Did you give the man his coffee? He didn't get him.
I was like thinking, did I come in to interview for the correct position? Because I thought this was a manager of diversity, not his assistant.
Stop. No, oh my gosh. No. It sounded so good up to that point.
Right? I was like, this is wow, like a good wow. This wasn't what we intended. I was like, wow, this is good. But we wanted some like scandalous stuff. Then you gave it to us. Then you gave us the tea or the coffee or whatever it was.
Yes. I have to tell you, you know, it was early in my career. I was in my early 30s. I wanted to do a great job. This was something I was so passionate about. And it was so heartbreaking for me because, you know, it was a man of color. He was the chief diversity officer for a global corporation. And then he added that one line. And I was just so upset. And at the same time, I don't know if you've ever felt this, but also started questioning myself. Like, did I really hear that? Was that correct?
Right.
And so, you know, I talked to a few of my friends and of course my husband. And at the end, I just decided not to pursue the opportunity.
Yeah. Did you get the feeling like that was just like a start of things to come? Like if he could say that to you, you know, in an interview, what else, you know, coffee? Okay. Yeah. I'm not getting your coffee, but then also what are the other expectations that were going to be coming from this person that were inappropriate and not aligned with, you know, your training, your work experience, your expertise and what your job function was supposed to be.
Yes. And also what that was against was my value.
Yeah.
Just my own like values of what it meant to be as a woman of color who wanted to do a really great job, who's ambitious and who is really passionate about diversity. This is
right.
It's not
right.
Like another job, but you know,
not coffee like, diversity, not like latte versus, you know, listen, I don't even know coffee. I don't even know the next thing to add.
Well, I'm like, was it a role play? Was he like trying to test you? Like, okay, let's see how about it she is and calling stuff out. Like, let me just throw it in there. And like, okay.
Well, I think if he was trying to do that, I think it's completely inappropriate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes. You don't set someone up that way. I'm like, yeah. You know, I mean, he didn't clarify afterwards, I'm assuming, so.
Yeah. He wasn't like, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
No, he wasn't. No, he just looked at me like, he just straight up looked at me.
Yeah, wow. See?
And
yeah,
I'm no. Just like, and I just, I don't know.
Right.
And, you know, and part of it too, and I think maybe, I don't know if it's a woman of color thing, you know, I started thinking, you know, is it me being an Asian American woman? Is it me being a young woman? Like, what if it was somebody else? Would he have said the same thing?
Yeah. Right. You know what I often think too when I find myself in these moments, because it can be uncomfortable to respond in the moment the way that, you know, when we're thinking about it hours later, we wish yes. we had responded. Yes. But I always think like, what would I tell my daughters? You know, like if it wouldn't be acceptable to me for my daughters, then it's not acceptable for me mm-hmm. either. You know, and if I can frame it that way, it often helps me know how to respond, because I certainly know how I want my daughters to respond in that moment. And listen, I'm sure you handled it with lots of class, but I'm not sure I would have.
Oh, no. Okay. But, I mean, yeah, it does bring up just a lot of like how you know, not everything needs to be addressed in the moment. My wondering too about it, and not that anyone has an answer, is like, was this the expectation for the next person who arrived, and did they then do it? Like, do people end up taking these, like, doing these things for these opportunities? So look, we are actually, can we like move to this next segment that we do every episode? Absolutely. So we've come to the part where we actually get questions from our listeners. And so I think this one is a perfect one, for you, cause you've worked with, companies such as JP Morgan and Chase, but, mm-hmm. and now you started this company with your husband. So this listener from Milwaukee, Wisconsin wants to know, when did you know that entrepreneurship was the right move for you?
That's a really good question, because I never thought in a million years growing up, I would even have or even start my own business. As someone who is a child of Filipino parents, mm-hmm. you can only be a few things. A doctor, a lawyer, and an engineer. And so
I've heard comedian Joe Coy tell this same story.
Yes. And so whatever is beyond that, they just don't understand. And, you know, I've always followed my passion. And really, the call for entrepreneurship was something that I never really thought about until I was at JP Morgan Chase. And I was a consultant, but not fully hired full time. And that was my, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was build my career in an organization. But unfortunately, they merged with Bank One, and so many of the consultants, because of a reorganization, consultants had to leave the company, and one of them was me. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to build my career in diversity. I interviewed with a few companies. I actually got an offer at ESPN during those early days, but I turned it down because I did not want to move to Bristol, Connecticut.
Oh.
I wanted to live. I wanted to be in New York City. And so one day my husband, Franz Johansson, he's always been in entrepreneurship. Mm. He was writing his book at that time. He's like, he just looked at me like nonchalantly. He's like, why don't you just start your own business? And in my head, I'm freaking out. I'm like, I looked at him and I said, are you kidding me? Like, what am I going to start? Like, what do you mean? Like, start my own company? He's like, I think it would be really great that if you start your own company, that if you ever wanted to go back into an organization, mm-hmm. you would be at a much higher level and a much higher pay grade. Mm-hmm. I'm like, really? And so since there weren't really any opportunities coming to me that I wanted to pursue, I remember being in my cubicle and looking around. I'm like, well, if I start a business, what is it going to be? Mm-hmm. I looked around and I said, at that point, I was managing the global employee resource groups at JP Morgan Chase. And I was like, you know what? No one's doing this. This is in every company. That's how I'm going to start my business. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start a consulting company on how to help organization effectively manage and start their employee resource groups. And I started telling people, and you know, I got invited to speak at a global diversity conference in Vienna. Ooh. I got introduced to a future business partner of mine who connected me to Spelman College.
Yay! Whoop whoop! We just celebrated our 139th anniversary. Yay! On Saturday. Yay, Spelman!
I feel like you know, I'm part of that school because I worked so closely with Spelman. But really, that's just how it started, and it's been interesting and exciting because I did build my career around diversity. I became knowledgeable about organizations and building a huge network of amazing chief diversity officers and C-level executives. And so, you know, I would have never thought that I would be an entrepreneur, but I'm really happy that I became an entrepreneur because you're just much more, you just have much more freedom to create. And I think that's what's so exciting about entrepreneurship is that you make things from nothing. Mm-hmm. And that is something that's really exciting.
Yeah.
And also bringing people along. And
well, you are talking to two other women of color entrepreneurs. Blanca has her own story of starting out on her own last year. And then I'm not really an entrepreneur. I work with my husband's company. He started the company. I never would have started a company on my own, like literally never. But I remember we interviewed Erica Hamilton a few weeks ago, and she was talking to me one time and talking to me about starting my own business. And I said to her, oh my gosh, I am so not entrepreneurial. And she said, don't you say that. She said, it's not true. And you're limiting yourself. And she said, you are entrepreneurial. And she listed all the reasons why. And I was like, oh, okay. Like maybe I am, you know, I talked myself out of it my entire life, just thinking, oh, well, I don't have that. That's not me. That's a gene that someone's born with, you know, and I didn't get it. But listening to her and listening to you and even Blanca, I'm like, oh, well, you know, maybe, you know, it's scary. Yeah.
It's super. I mean, I think the other thing to think about too, and even when you were saying Sweet Joy, like, you know, your husband turns to you and says like, why don't you start your own business? The idea that other people see it in us before we see it in ourselves is like, that part is just where the imposter syndrome sort of like, who, me? Like me? Yeah. Right? Like, why did you say that? And so it just makes me think a lot about how we talk ourselves out of these opportunities and like, and the reality too, I think systemically, right? Of how if you're a woman, you're a person of color, you're getting paid less than other people in the professional world. So it's like, who's going to invest in me? Who's going to do, you know, like all of these things just that come in to stall you a little bit longer until you get that that moment, right?
Yeah. And the thing is, it's about starting because you just never know, like maybe your first business isn't the one that's going to, you know, as an entrepreneur, you have a series of businesses. So my first one was just by myself being a consultant.
Right.
And then I was asked because of my position and where I was with my business, you know, I was asked to join to be a partner for a cross-cultural leadership organization. And then when my husband started to really look at the impact of the Medici Effect, his book, and corporations wanting the thought leadership in their organization, he turned to me and said, I want you to help build this company with me. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is, when you have to take small steps, and it might not, right. you know, work right in the beginning, because, you know, being an entrepreneur, you just hustle.
Yeah.
You hustle.
Yeah.
And it's a great kind of hustling in terms of, you know, meeting different kinds of people and seeing where the opportunities take you.
And I think as women, go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead, Ray.
I was just going to say that I think as women, I actually think we're uniquely positioned to mm-hmm. succeed as entrepreneurs. I think that so many of us are used to running households. And I always say, if you can run a household, you can probably run a business, you know, because there are so many different considerations. We know how to budget. We know how to plan. We know how to execute. We know how to make difficult decisions. Mm-hmm. We know how to pivot, you know, all the things that are required of business leaders and entrepreneurs. And, you know, my family, we're mm-hmm. a fan of yeah. Shark Tank. And they say all the time that their most successful businesses are overwhelmingly mm-hmm. the ones that are run by women, you know? And so I like what, you know, I love your story, Sweet Joy, and kind of being in your cubicle and looking around and saying, wait a minute, like this thing that I'm doing it for myself.
It's so funny because, you know, that's not the business, you know, that I'm doing, even though we do help organizations with their employee resource groups. But I see lots of organizations right now working on employee resource groups. And I'm just like, oh my God, I remember when I was doing that 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So to the listener too, I mean, and to folks out there, you know, the other thing to think about is like, if you are working somewhere, is how do you start to get your hand in while working somewhere? How do you start to get your feet wet? Just, you know, doing a few little projects on the side. It is a hustle. Like Sweet Joy said, it is a hustle. But it's like, how do you start to build a clientele before you even launch? Like that kind of, I mean, that's what I ended up doing. And then I was like, well, why am I'm working like 3-4 jobs right mm-hmm. now, plus mothering, plus like all the things, right? And so mm-hmm. slowly building it so that you, if fear is driving you, then at least having something behind you to say, hey, I have created something. I have been working on something. I do have people. Yeah.
And kind of testing the waters first. I think that's really great advice, Blanca. Yay, well, Sweet Joy, it has been such a pleasure having you on here. I feel like you are as sweet and as joyful as your name is, and as wise too. Maybe we should tack that on there as well. I know our listeners are going to get so much from hearing about your experience. I am going to actually pick up that book, The Medici Effect, and read it myself. And so would love to invite our listeners to do the same. I'm sure that it will just continue to grow our understanding about diversity in the workplace and why it matters and how to help our organizations get there. So thank you so much. And I would love to invite you to share your affirmation to leave with our listeners. Affirmation.
Great. And so my affirmation is, it's a grounding affirmation for me because I do it with breath. And for us, especially for me, when I start to worry or I start getting anxious about the future or anything that's happening in the world, breath is something I've learned to help ground me. So I take a big, you know, breath in. And then when I take a breath out, I tell myself, I have grace within. And so I do this a few times a day, especially during this pandemic. And I'm actually in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm hearing ambulance mm-hmm. sirens go off yep. every minute. Yep. And so that is something that's helping me at this point in time, because it's so needed yeah. that for us, especially as women of color, because we have so many responsibilities and feel so responsible for so many things that we take it to ourselves to really make sure that we feel safe in our own bodies so we can feel calm and we can feel focused.
Beautiful. Thank you so I am going to be much. Doing that several yeah. times today, Sweet Joy. So thank you for sharing.
Sweet Joy. We loved every second of thank it. Thank you. You so much for sharing.
Yes, and health and wellness to your family during this time as well.
Yes, both of you too, and thank you. I feel so honored to be with you today and having me be part of this amazing podcast. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure.
It was great to have Sweet Joy on the talk, on the call, on the, I don't even know.
The interview, right?
The interview, right? Or the interview.
Yeah.
And just like, just what resonated, what stuck with me. Obviously this entrepreneurial path is a big thing, but you know, what I was just thinking about the internal dialogue we have to get us through this imposter syndrome and strategies we use to empower ourselves. So even how she left us with the grounding affirmation of grace within ourselves.
Yeah.
And so I just think a lot about like the, you know, you and I have talked about this all the time, and we talked about this in the past, and a lot of the women I work with and coach and all the things is how the internal demon of internalized messages that, you know, translates into imposter syndrome. And then we doubt ourselves. We don't belong. All the things, right? That, right. You know, Sweet Joy mentioned. And as a response, we start to overcompensate. We over-volunteer. We do the most, right? We do a lot of things, particularly in organizations, to make sure that we are seen as being worthy of the position. And so...
So true.
Right. So I think one of the things that I was just thinking about is just how do we, you know, honor those feelings because they're real, right? And also be able to say, no, I'm here for a purpose and a reason. I'm not a number filler. I actually have a voice. I have power. And how do I tap into that? And what is my self-dialogue? For me, it was my, you know, like warrior poses. For Sweet Joy, it's her breathing and the affirmations, the internal affirmations. So I think I was left a lot with that, particularly as I think about all the hats that we're playing during this time of pandemic, when people are trying to figure out like how they show up at work and how they show up at home and how they show up for friends and how they show up for everyone. But how do we, you know, first tap into ourselves? So
yeah,
I don't know. How about you?
Her internal dialogue was so powerful.
Yeah.
I was just like, man, what a gift to be able to speak those things to yourself, you know, constantly over and over again. And so that definitely resonated with me as well. You know, for me, I think what I would say that I am really walking away, mulling over, is her approach to diversity work. Mm-hmm. And it really aligns with what I came to believe about the work when I was in the position at City or New York, and just that people are always looking for these quick fixes, and these large companies are certainly no different. Mm-hmm. And they think that you bring in a diversity consultant and they do their one thing and then they leave, and now everybody at your company should be fine. Like they should be better. They should get it. And it just doesn't work that way. And so I'm hoping that as we continue with this kind of work in the years to come, that as a country, we are really able to pivot in the way that we think about diversity work and actually invest in it. One of my worries with this pandemic actually is that companies are really going to start tightening their belts and deciding what's essential work and what isn't essential work as they seek to recover lost revenue and all that kind of stuff. And I do worry that some of the headway that we were making in terms of companies making room in their C-suites for diversity officers, I do worry that on the heels of this pandemic, that progress might halt as people seek to recover. So we'll see. But I do at the very least hope that one, we keep the positions, but that we also start to rethink their value and what's actually needed in terms of deep culture shifts within companies and not these kind of one-offs, hit it and quit it kind of, you know, diversity training. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, and I think the pandemic is a great example of how the numbers of inequity, how it impacts Black and Brown people on so many fronts, not just health disparities, but who's on the front line on MTA buses out here. At least I'll speak for New York, right? Where who's showing up for work? Who's out there and, you know, who's cleaning up? Who's in the restaurants? Who's doing these things, right? And who are we sending in the front line? And, you know, God bless all the first responders, right? Like that is not the question. There's no doubt that there's, you know, probably diversity in that. But then there's other folks who are constantly being exposed and being told that their job is essential, but never being messaged that they are essential.
Right. Oh, right? My gosh, Blanca, so, you're so right. There's so many parallels between this pandemic and the things that we discuss in diversity all the time. Like, even down to Black and brown folks, I see are really starting to be blamed for the fact that we are dying at higher rates. And it's being blamed on our lifestyles, our diets, and all those things without anybody actually, I shouldn't say anybody, but few people actually being willing to dig deeper and say, no. What are the systemic issues, the societal issues that have existed for 100 years in this company, in this country that have contributed to, you know, worse health outcomes for Black and brown people? That's the conversation. And just like you said, what are the jobs that we are doing? We still have to drive the buses. We still have to show up for our at the MTA, for the subways and the grocery store clerks. And so let's talk about that before you place the blame squarely on Black and brown people. Let's talk about the things going on around it. So, oh my gosh, girl, we could have a
but also, like I said, this is an opportunity, right? To like, you know, put up. So I'm grateful that Sweet Joy has also gifted us with like ways to think about this, right? On an entrepreneur front, on an organizational front, on a personal front, right? Just different ways, whether it's self-talk for us, whether it's for organizations to not do a quick fix, right? So I don't know.
So awesome. Well, listen, girl, we are so powerful that we get to talk to so many powerful women.
I know, and get re-inspired.
Right?
And that's the whole point. I know. Yes. I could go make my other cup of coffee to get through the day.
We trying to stay woke at work. We trying to stay woke at work. How about you? You trying to stay woke at work? If you trying to stay woke at work, stay true, stay true. We trying to stay woke at work. We trying to stay woke at work. How about you? You trying to stay woke at work? Woke at work, woke at work. Stay true, stay true.
Shout out to the North Star for making Woke at Work possible. If you are not a member of the North Star, you can head over to thenorthstar.com, create an account, and enjoy some of the paid content in addition to the free content that we offer. Thank you to the thousands of members who currently support this work that make this podcast, other podcasts, and all types of media that we offer, Speaking Truth to Power, possible. So again, that's thenorthstar.com. We really appreciate your support. I also want to thank Lysandra, our podcasting director, Willis, our producer, who is also responsible for this awesome music, as well as Tone and everyone else behind the scenes who make this podcast work.
Now, if you want to support us, please go to your favorite podcasting app and subscribe, and please leave a review. We'd appreciate it so much if you could leave your best review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. If any of your other podcasting apps accept reviews, by all means, leave one there too. So remember, whether you're listening on Instagram, the North Star website, or wherever you listen to this, we appreciate you showing us your love by going to a podcasting app, subscribing, and leaving a review. Thanks so much, y'all, for all the love and support. And don't forget to tell a friend. We appreciate you.